This is SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.
This episode of The Secrets of the Hobbit is brought to you by you, the listener. We are approaching the end of another amazing year for Catholic New Media. With SQPN, we have been able to reach people from all over the world with engaging, entertaining, Hobbit-filled, and inspiring programs. For the next year, we ask for your help. Support our mission with a gift or a monthly donation and help us to continue what we do and to launch even more exciting new media initiatives. Go to sqpn.com/donate to find out how you can help. SQPN, we are here for you. And thanks to you.
SQPN.com presents The Secrets of the Hobbit.
There and back again. A Hobbit's Tale by Bilbo Baggins. Now, where to begin?
Welcome back to a new episode of The Secrets of the Hobbit, the show where we cover everything, anything, and anyone that has to do with the story of The Hobbit and the three movies by Peter Jackson from New Zealand, the first one of which is now officially in theaters. Well, not in all theaters. We're still waiting over here in Europe and in the United States as well, but the day is getting closer. I'm joined, just like last week, by my two co-hosts, Dave Keel from California, the United States, the West Coast. How is the weather over there?
I'm looking out the window right now. It's sunny. It's probably like in the upper 60s. Very nice.
Ooh, sounds so good. Also joining us today is Inge Lutz from Groningen. I actually should say Lutz because it's pronounced in a Dutch way. So you're all the way in the northern part of the same country that I live in, the Netherlands. What's the weather outside your window, Inge?
It's heavily snowing. So Dave, do you have a spare bedroom?
Yes, and an air mattress.
Oh, sunshine and snow.
It's like 33, so around freezing outside.
Fahrenheit, yeah.
Yeah.
It's just like Middle Earth, you know. If you travel from the Shire to the Misty Mountains, you get the same kind of differences in weather. Well, of course, we're not going to talk about the weather here. We are going to talk about The Hobbit, and we covered part of the red premiere, the red carpet premiere last week, but we still want to talk about so many other cool interviews that were given during that event that was streamed live via the internet, and millions of people have been able to watch it. Of course, we want to talk about what was said there, and we want to give you a first impression of, well, the initial reviews of the movie. Dave, give me a kind of an overview of what are the people saying? Do we have to worry about The Hobbit, or can we go to the first movie with a peaceful heart?
I think fans like us don't need to worry. For the most part, all of the reviews that I've seen seem to be fairly impressive. In fact, actually, an EW article I was reading, I think, summed them up well. That The Hobbit, in terms of reviews, The Hobbit is having kind of the same sort of problem that Pixar's Brave had a few months ago, which is what the critics are saying is it was really good, but not as good as I wanted it to be, basically.
Right.
Very good, but it wasn't great.
Mm-hmm.
What a lot of people are saying, some of the critics are sort of complaining about the sorts of things we expected them to. Some people are saying it's long. It's really, really long, and that there's kind of some slow moments, which is not unexpected, given that they split it up into three films and that the first one only ends at the eagle rescue, it seems. Mm-hmm. So I think we felt like that it might be a little bit slow. And also people are complaining that it's maybe a little more childish and it's not quite as serious. There's a lot of paradox in mm-hmm. the things people are saying. A lot of people are saying like it's simultaneously darker and scarier and also more childish.
Interesting.
So it seems almost incoherent. Nobody's giving it bad reviews that I've seen. There's been a couple people, but the bad reviews seem like the kind of bad reviews that people would write when everybody else was writing good
reviews.
Right.
They probably set out to write a bad review. They were planning on, we got to be critical because everybody's going to rave about this movie. So I, as a high profile movie critic, of course have to point out what all the other people are missing. It's a dreadful movie.
Yeah. I have heard complaints about the 48 frames per second.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, that was to be expected as well because it's new and we're not used to this. And what are people saying?
There was an article on OneRing.net where they were interviewing some news outlets in New Zealand had said that there were moviegoers reporting that they had gotten, felt sick or dizzy or had headaches or whatever from watching it. And it kind of, again, it read like one of those things where they probably went around and asked every single person they could find, did you get dizzy? Did you get sick? Mm-hmm. Just to find somebody who did. And then they, could publish an article saying, Hobbit makes fans sick. So,
yeah.
I think it's a little bit the same as what you have with video games. Some people who are prone to motion sickness will get sick from playing video games. And I can see that's the same mechanism that will work for this kind of movies. But yeah, that's only a small minority of people.
I would have thought that the 48 frames per second would actually enhance the 3D experience. One of the things that I've noticed a few times, just very rarely, because normally I don't have any trouble with 3D movies, but sometimes if you have fast camera moves and the 24 frames per second introduces this judder, basically where the movements aren't smooth anymore, and if the camera's panning very fast, it's hard to process. You almost get this stroboscopic effect. I remember this on the Beowulf. Remember that one? It's a dreadful movie. In 3D, it's even worse. But it was so artificial, and it was another one of those movies where they love sticking swords in your face, all the time. Like, look, 3D! I'm going to poke this into your face. And that was a movie where a few times I just took off the glasses. But I think that with 48 frames per second, it's going to be much more, fluid and less jittery, and therefore perhaps less nausea-inducing. But you say.
You would think so, but I really think what we're going to find is that all kinds of – there's so many different kinds of people out there that there's always going to be some people that just don't respond well.
What are people saying about the story, and are people – happy with how this movie version turns out, at least the first part of it? Is it close enough to Tolkien, or are people upset about all these changes? What have you heard?
That's a good question. I mean, because most of the reviews I've read don't sound like they're being written by people who are major Tolkien fans. I do think, I saw a couple reviews from U.S. Reviewers that were here's a guy, Ethan Sachs in the New York Daily, who says, like all unexpected journeys, there are a few pitfalls along the way, most notably the tangential subplot surrounding bumbling wizard Radagast the Brown, whose buffoonery at times descends into gasp Jar Jar Binks territory.
Oh, is that the review with the title Jackson is a Wizard with a Jar Jar Binks warning?
That was that's an article on stuff.co.nz referencing this other US review. Article about the review.
Right.
So, yeah, I've seen a few people make comments like that it has prequelitis that some people said nobody's claiming it's as quote unquote bad. Maybe people disagree with that, but nobody's saying it's as bad as the Star Wars prequels. But there's some people that's saying that it has some of the same problems, or people who say that they feel like it has the same problems, that the filmmaking, the technology, all of that stuff is improved, but the story and the writing are actually not as good.
I've read a couple of reviews where people, the reviewers were like, that Peter Jackson tries to cram too much lore into the first movie, which makes it very slow. He's using a lot of time for exposition.
Okay.
And that was criticism as well. And because of all the criticism and explaining and putting in extra stuff, it's not action-driven as much as other movies. And yeah, I can see. I already said that in some episodes ago that there's not much action in the first part of the book, except for the trolls and maybe the chasing with the wargs. But yeah, and if you use the rest of the time for exposition, and for the just very casual viewer who is not a nut, I can see that's kind of hard to digest. But yeah, we need to see the movie first to give a real.
When I read comments like, "Oh, the movie is a bit slow and takes time for exposition," I personally don't think that that's a bad thing per se. I'd rather have a story with a bit more depth and a bit more background, because if it's just an action-filled thing, that was kind of my worry. My concern was that, oh, it's going to be, it's so little of the story in this first movie. It's all going to be action. It's all going to be, you know, dwarves running around, and so they're going to expand on the action stuff, which makes a movie less interesting to rewatch. Whereas if there's a lot of lore in this and a lot of exposition, it's probably going to be worth watching it again or several times and taking it in. And I don't know. I don't know if I worry too much about that. I think it might actually help the longevity of the movie at the box office, because people might want to see it a second time to get the entire story. I don't know. If you've seen one car chase, you know, and that's kind of the highlight of the movie, you won't go back because you've already seen how it ends. But with this, I don't know, might be I'd like it if there's more content and more exposition.
Well, and paradoxically, that's the kind of stuff that will make the Hobbit fans really excited.
Yes, yeah, I think so too.
We'll be happy to sit and listen to 2.5 hours of just expounding upon the history of Middle-earth.
Well, I think the most Hobbit fans, they don't care how long the movie is or how slow at times. It's a Hobbit movie. It's Tolkien, you know. It's going to be amazing. Let's go back to last week with the red carpet premiere, where during the whole broadcast of that event, we got to meet a lot of the actors that... well, are now starting their rise to fame. Some of them were already well known, but most of them, you know, it's like, who is this John Callan? Who is Peter Hambleton? And I think that these actors will all be household names in a couple of months from now. And so I'm going to play a few of those sound clips. We'll talk about it. And then if we have some more time at the end of the show, we'll go back to the rest of the news concerning The Hobbit. So let's first go back to the red carpet here.
You're done. Confound it all, Samwise Gamgee. Have you been eavesdropping?
I ain't been dropping no eaves, sir, honest.
What did you hear? Speak!
Nothing important. Please, Mr. Gandalf, sir, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me in anything unnatural.
So the first person we're going to hear is Sir Richard Taylor. Of course, the head of, I suppose he's the head of Weta Studios. So he's in charge of all the special effects. And
what's your favorite thing you designed? What's the favorite thing you got your hands on that went from the drawing board to actually being in your hand?
Without doubt, the 13 dwarves, of course. I loved them as a child in my head when I read the book, and now being able to create them is an amazing thing.
A lot of people have been talking about the technological advances and the way the film has been shot. What can you say about the way it has developed over the last time?
Well, as Peter does always, he pushes technology to the absolute limit, and this film has incorporated every new groundbreaking technique that he's able to use to make great cinema.
Well, pushing the boundaries of new technology, definitely, with the 48 frames per second and the improved 3D, quite revolutionary. Even the cameras that they use are, you know, top-notch, whereas usually in the movie industry, they tend to kind of use slightly more, you know, older, proven technology. Peter Jackson took a big leap of faith, I think, in new technology by using these very light, weren't they red cameras?
Yes.
This is going to be 3D that's going to be much more dynamic, I think, than anything we've seen before, because with a lot of the true 3D films, I'm not talking about the movies that are kind of retro graded with 3D, with traditional 3D, camera can't move around that much because the cameras are heavy. Now, by using these lighter cameras, I think you can do much more, even Steadicam stuff within 3D, which you might not notice and you might not be aware of it, but that is pretty groundbreaking. In the first part of this little chat, Sir Richard Taylor said he was particularly proud of the dwarves. And Inga or Dave, have you heard anything about the let's say, the group dynamic of the dwarves? What do people say about the way they're portrayed? Does it work?
I haven't read anything about the dwarves, to be honest.
What about you, Dave? Any first impressions of the dwarves?
It's kind of surprising. People seem to be, in most of the reviews that I'm looking at, people aren't really commenting about the individual performances of the dwarves. It's sort of funny because, after all, one of the things in getting ready to make the film, one of the things a lot of people talked about was like how, you know, in the books, the dwarves tend to be just the dwarves.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of them that have individual identities like Balin and Thorin, but in general, they're just the dwarves and you don't really know anything about the individual dwarves. And they made so much effort to give each an individual unique look, and they invented backstories for a lot of them. And yet, reading through the reviews, people return to just talking about the dwarves.
Yeah. Couldn't that be because people don't really remember the original story that well, and so they just assume that this is all based on what Tolkien already wrote down, and so they don't really realize how much you know they've turned this pretty kind of like, let's say, how do you say that? I had a wonderful English word in my mind and then it escaped me. This anamorphous, something with morphous, and this bland group of dwarves into something that has really depth and character and internal dynamics. That's what I'm looking forward to most. I kind of think I know what a hobbit will be, but the dwarves, I'm so curious. Because we only know this one dwarf from The Lord of the Rings, and he was kind of a peculiar dwarf. So
yeah, very undwarfish, like liking elves and stuff.
Yeah.
Hey. Well, I'm starting with people talking about sort of, you know, I'm just starting to think that actually, you know, despite their best efforts to make each of these dwarves unique, I mean, how much screen time can any one dwarf character get? How much of each individual performance can we really watch and enjoy? And I'm betting when you're sitting there in the theater for 2.5 hours, you know, it probably just goes right by you and you don't really have time to take in like, wow, you know, so-and-so is doing a really great job as Glowin or Bomber or whatever. And so I'm wondering if it's one of those things that fans, if they go back and rewatch it 50 times, will really be able to focus in on like, oh, you know, is this person doing a good portrayal of this character? But when you're watching the film, you probably barely notice. You probably really don't have time. And especially I read somewhere that somebody did say that like the sheer sort of beauty of the 48 frames per second 3D, especially with action sequences and stuff, sometimes overwhelms the performances. Like you just don't have – you can't enjoy an individual. They said even – this especially happens with Martin Freeman, that sometimes you just – you forget he's even in the scene because you're
really
taking in the visuals.
Yeah, of course, that's a danger with this new technique, because people are not used to it, so it's in a movie which has all kinds of new techniques, and you have all a story which is kind of familiar in a new coat,
mm-hmm.
and it's maybe too much
December,
to take in.
Discover.
Oh, excuse me, I was preloading a movie clip here.
I wanted to say, so mm-hmm. it's a lot of to process, especially if your mind is kind of programmed to recognize a movie when you'll watch a movie, because it kind of detects the 24 frames per second. And if you suddenly sit in a movie theater just kind of expecting 24 frames per second, because that's what you have been watching your whole life as being a movie, and suddenly are presented with 48 frames per second and 3D and this movie, that may be too much for one sitting, so you have to watch it multiple times too. to get everything out of it.
Any reason that makes me watch this movie several times is a good reason.
Yeah, there's a review. Unsurprisingly, the best reviews, I think, for our purposes as fans are on the OneRing.net right now from people who are fans. And one guy, Mr. Sear, it says that people will definitely want to, if they really want to enjoy sort of some of the softer moments and the character acting and whatnot, that they really need to see it multiple times, especially if you see it in 48 frames per second. He's the guy that really emphasizes, if you see this for the first time in 48 frames per second 3D, you're going to spend most of the film just kind of being overwhelmed by the visuals, and you're not really going to have a chance to enjoy the story or the characters or the acting. So he says you definitely want to go back for another viewing.
I can imagine that I'm going to watch this one in 3D and in 48 frames per second and even in 2D, just to be able to focus more on the story and the acting and not get distracted in a way by the 3D.
Yep.
Hey, there were some new TV spots as well in the kind of after the premiere in New Zealand, and TV spot number 9 caught my attention because the description says it has glimpses of Smaug.
Mm-hmm.
Let's listen.
I often think of the Shire. See, that's where I belong. That's home. You don't have one. It was taken from you, but I will help you take it back if I can.
Oh, wow.
On December 14th, see the journey that started it all. From the director of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey. This film is not yet rated. Real D3D and IMAX 3D, December 14th.
That is amazing. I assume that's Dale. You see the destruction of Dale, right?
Yep.
I think so, yeah.
And you see this tail of a flying dragon, a pretty huge dragon, and lots of fire.
It had a lot of Balrog qualities to me, because you see fire.
Oh, I don't even... I just saw something moving that definitely evoked a dragon. But it looks amazing. I love the kind of the camera sweeping over the city, and it looks like an amazing action scene, actually. It's just, like, not even a second long, but... Let me play that again.
Yeah, I freeze framed it. It looked, yeah, it looks a lot like a flying lizard.
I'm freeze framing right now. I see a huge explosion of a tower.
Yeah, he's doing his morning breath over a tower.
You see the entire tower, and you see something. It looks like bat-like wings, almost dark black wings.
Yeah.
So he's not red, as far as I can tell here. Now I see a huge tail. The tail is shows you how big creature
is. It's like a lizard tail. It's has a pointy tail with a...
Yeah.
It's, you know, like, what? Like, it's like a spearhead.
The way they portray this is almost similar to what I remember from the movie Cloverfield. Remember that one with that mysterious monster? And for a long time, you don't get to see the monster. You only see glimpses that make you aware that this is a huge monster. And I wonder if they're going to do the same thing with Smaug here as well, where we will never get to see the entire dragon. We'll just get to get this awe for this huge creature. That is so much bigger than I imagined it to be. Pretty amazing. There's a second clip here too. Let me
wait.
You didn't notice
what I considered to be the biggest piece of news there. Like the Smaug thing is pretty exciting, but
is it the thing at the end where
it's right around 20 seconds, right after you see the eagles, then you see the dwarves on the hills.
The battle.
Yes.
Is that Azanulbazar?
It's almost certainly Azanulbazar.
Oh, wow. It's a huge dwarf. It's definitely a dwarven army. And on the other side, what looks like orcs, if I see correctly. They seem to have the same type of armor that we've seen in Lord of the Rings as well. The dwarves have very different armor from what I expected. Looks like brown leather. They all look similar. They have all the same armor. Wow.
Yep, it almost certainly is Azanulbazar. It really can't be anything else. There's the only other battle we know of that involves a large dwarf army is the Battle of Five Armies. And that's been confirmed that they really haven't filmed very much of that yet, and they wouldn't release footage of it at this point. So.
No.
And there's clips in the second trailer, the second TV spot that look like Thorin involved in that battle, and it's like a younger Thorin with a different sword. So it's pretty certainly as an Ulbazar. So that obviously is very exciting. Pair that with Richard Armitage's statements, and it looks like we're going to get as an Ulbazar.
Oh, so glad. So glad. This is another one of those mysteries that we talked about for so many months.
Yes.
And we get to see it. It's amazing. So, and the thing that I was looking at is like, what is that? Is the thing that they show you in the background when they say this film is not yet rated, etc. And you see this bridge, and it's a very bleak, kind of bluish structure, and it leads to what looks like runes on a mountain. Is that Gandalf walking there?
Dol Guldur. Cannot be anything else, I think.
Yep.
It's Dol Guldur, which Dol is a hill, and Guldur is sorcery or black sorcery. That's what it means. So.
Black sorcery hill, well. It looks very dark, and I remember that there was a production video, and they were shooting with Ian McKellen. They were shooting stuff with Gandalf, and the production had the weather was terrible. It was like these dark clouds, and it was almost like a thunderstorm was about to be set loose. And I remember that they said, you know, these clouds, we didn't plan for it, but we might actually use this in the final, in the movie as well. We won't have to change this in post. And when I look at this particular scene, even if it's just 2 seconds, it looks to me that they actually did that. And those, I mean, I imagine that the hill and the runes are a model or CGI, but the clouds in the background look exactly the same as what we saw in that production video. That's pretty neat.
Mm-hmm.
It's I'm amazed that they show so much in these TV spots. Can I now move over to the other TV spot?
Yes, I would go to the second link I put under number 9 is the same trailer.
Okay.
The one under number 10, somebody filmed their television, so the quality is awful.
Now I've got here the Hobbit Smaug the Dragon TV spot number 10. So I'm not sure if that's the same link,
it might be. It's. I think it's pretty much the same trailer.
Okay, let's check just to be on the safe side.
I often think of the Shire. See, that's where I belong. That's home. You don't have one.
Dragon
taken from you. But I will help you take it back if I can.
I think so. Yeah, the Shire looks gorgeous. The helicopter shot.
Mm-hmm. See the journey that started it all.
Oh, there's a ring in here. We've got the dishes. What are these bird-like things? Oh!
The eagles.
Oh, the eagles!
Yep.
Oh, wow.
This film is not yet rated.
Yeah, this is the same trailer. December 14th. Might have had slightly different pacing. The eagles! There are tons of eagles in the skies there. Fantastic.
Yeah, those are the great eagles from the Misty Mountains.
Oh, wow.
And we also see them later in the Battle of the Five Armies.
Oh man, I'm so looking forward to the eagles. I picked up the Lord of the Rings. What is it? War in the North game during the fall sale or the autumn sale on Steam for $5. I was like,
wow.
Yeah, I'm not gonna. I want to try it out for $5.
It was like $40 or something like
that. Yes, and I'm pretty sure it will return in the winter sale as well. So I've been playing the very first part of the game features this huge bird, and it's amazing. I was like, if the movie is going to be anything like this, it's so impressive. It's just very cool, and it talks.
Yes.
Which again is like, is this going to be copied in the movie as well? I think if with the Riddles game. With the Riddles in the Dark podcast, I said that no, we won't see any talking animals, but I'm starting to wonder.
Well, those eagles better talk, because there's a whole dialogue in a book between the eagles and the company.
But I just, I was like, it's going to be a children's movie if we get talking animals. It's going to be unrealistic.
It is kind of a children's
book. I know, but we haven't seen any talking animals in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, but then again, we haven't seen any talking not orcs, but Trolls in the trilogy either, so why not? And I was just unsure if it would work, but in the game, it really works. Like, yeah, I totally, you know, that works in that environment. Why not? So
yeah, that was one of my pet peeves of the trilogy, is that, for example, wargs didn't talk.
Yeah. Well, I'm very much looking forward to the scene with the eagles. Let's go and listen to what one of the dwarves has to say on the red carpet. This is Oin, played by John Callan.
What was really clear in the media conference earlier this morning was the close brotherhood between all of the dwarves. It is amazing. Was it simply through spending so much time together, or are you a natural... Is there natural chemistry between you all?
Well, both of those things, really. I have worked with a number of the New Zealand actors in it, so knew them already. And so there was a great, tremendous energy there already. And then meeting up with all the wonderful actors who've come from overseas, it just built on the whole thing. It just carried on. It was wonderful.
What was the most difficult, the most challenging part of the business for you?
I guess... being somewhat older than some of them, I did find it a little difficult to keep up with them sometimes, you know, especially wearing huge costumes. It was a bit hot, it was a bit heavy, and if they said, sorry, we've got to start again tomorrow, I would do it.
John, you've seen the film, and your thoughts about it?
I think it's an extraordinary piece of work. I think it takes the wonderful feeling for Aotearoa that we have, and it extends that through the new ideas that Peter Jackson has brought to it, the new technology that he's added to it. The whole thing, I think, has taken filmmaking to a much higher level than it was.
So, Oin, about the dwarven camaraderie. And one thing, Dave, that we've been speculating about at length was whether or not we would hear more of the dwarven language, which is not really developed that much by J.R.R. Tolkien. Are there any indications that we will hear something else than Baruch Arad, that kind of stuff?
I confess I haven't seen any, and no one's, you know, you would think that might be the kind of thing that the OneRing.net reviewers mm-hmm. might mention, but I haven't heard anything.
Interesting.
But there, I think the only dwarven or Khuzdul language mm-hmm. We see in the books is kind of in an appendix, and they basically only translate Baruch Azad and Kazad Amenu. So that's only the two. Basically, the two phrases we kind of get, so it's kind of hard to build on that.
But you would expect at least, isn't it indicated in the book that these dwarves do speak dwarven language when they're amongst themselves, and that they have to translate it to Bilbo, or perhaps I just imagine that.
I confess I can't remember.
Question.
I mean, the one thing we know for sure about the dwarven language is that they're incredibly secretive about it, and they mm-hmm. don't teach other people. So, so actually, that might argue against that. Maybe they maybe they intentionally won't speak in dwarvish in front of Bilbo. Maybe we won't. It seems highly unlikely that Peter Jackson, given how much Elvish he put in the other film and how much they really enjoyed kind of not just using Elvish, but even having characters say things in Elvish that they didn't say in the book. They really kind of expanded on the
language.
And
they made it sound very real, like a language that you could actually learn.
Yeah. So I find it really hard to imagine that they wouldn't do that here, but I could be wrong. But they haven't. I mean, there's been nothing, as far as I know, to you know, no evidence, nothing to confirm or deny this. No one's mentioned it, and you know, I haven't seen any reviews where they mentioned how awesome the scenes in Dwarvish were, or how distracting they found it. And it, you know, maybe from the standpoint of this is kind of a more of a kids movie, maybe those are elements that they wouldn't necessarily include. You know, maybe kids would find that more distracting or whatever. I don't know.
Could be. The movie probably doesn't need it, but it would be cool. I'm still hoping for, you know, like the Tolkien fanboy equivalent of the Klingon language. You know, that in future Tolkien Middle Earth type of conventions, You can actually distinguish yourself by speaking the dwarven language.
I think one of the differences with the elven language is that in the trilogy, in the books, there's specific references, for example, of Aragorn speaking Elvish to elves he meets.
Mm-hmm.
And elves speaking Elvish to each other. And I cannot remember that from the book that much. So that would also argue against using dwarven language in a movie. Also, but what I just said, there's almost nothing known about the dwarven language, and there's much more known about the elven language.
Yes, it would be a stretch also. They would basically have to hire a linguist to develop that dwarven language, because Tolkien has never done that. So,
which I mean, I wouldn't put that past them. I'm just saying that nobody's... Nobody's said or revealed anything that indicates that they've done that. So, and it maybe that'll be something that they'll do more of in the second film or whatever. I don't know.
We'll see. Also present on the red carpet, of course, was Peter Jackson himself, and he was asked what his favorite part of the movie was.
I'm not sure if you've been asked this question, but what is your favorite part of this movie? You can't say all of it either.
No, well, I mean, I haven't really seen the movie properly. I've seen it kind of once through, but tonight's the first time I'm going to sit down and watch it really with an audience. I like Bilbo. I think Martin Freeman is absolutely brilliant as Bilbo, and I like the wonderful sense of comic timing that he brings to the movie.
So Peter Jackson, very positive about the performance of Bilbo in the movie, Martin Freeman. I guess that a lot of the reviews are in agreement about that. I haven't read that many of them, but I've not seen any complaints about the way that Bilbo is portrayed. Well, what I like about it, it's a very different character from Frodo.
Mm-hmm.
Neither have I heard about the small part that takes place with the old Bilbo and Frodo, if that works.
Yeah, nobody's mentioned anything about that. That's actually, no one said, and you know, I guess this is not a surprise. They were on, the reviewers were under embargo until like this
week.
2 days
ago?
Oh, okay.
Monday.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they weren't even allowed to say anything. And there's been a couple people that broke the embargo and wrote reviews anyway. But there hasn't been, I mean, they've been under embargo. And even beyond that, I imagine that the embargo, even moving forward, I imagine that they've been told under penalty of you won't get to see the other two films, don't reveal details.
Right.
And so maybe they've been told not to mention specific scenes.
That's possible.
I noticed the OneRing.net people. So one of the reviews was written by, one of their senior, Torn friends and staffers, Garfamau, who basically said that, you know, like she wrote a really, really terse, very short review, and she mentioned a couple scenes, like the Riddles in the Dark scene. In fact, she said that Riddles in the Dark made her cry. But beyond that, didn't really say anything. And I wonder if they've been told not to reveal details and not to mention specific scenes and things like that. But no, it's interesting. No one has mentioned, you know, you would think that reviewers would say something about that, like the frame story really worked or the frame story didn't work.
Yep.
We really enjoyed the prologue and how it introduced story or anything. But nobody said anything like that.
I don't mind that, because at least for us, it will be a surprise. And we can form our own opinion, so I'm not complaining.
And
about that.
Of course, this is a handpicked audience, of course. So if they know that some people are very critical of the whole movie or the franchise, mm-hmm. they won't invite those people. So I'm kind
Perhaps.
Of interested to see what will happen after the official premiere, that when the big audience can see it in cinema, what kind of reviews emerge from the internet then. So we will get more diverse opinions from that point forward.
Of course, the mm-hmm. premiere has been in New Zealand, in Wellington, but when are the Kiwis actually going to see this movie? Or are they already? Is it?
Man, I can't remember. What is the...
I don't remember.
I think it's
either.
The same same for New Zealand and Europe. It's December the 12th.
So that would explain why we haven't seen that much leaking out, because most of the journalists have only seen it once. And so no wonder that their reviews are going to be about the entire movie, because they haven't been able to rewatch it.
Yeah, The premiere in Wellington was last week, and mm-hmm. then nobody's getting it until the 12th.
Okay. Wow, that's the same day as we get it in the Netherlands.
Yes.
Pretty cool. All right.
It's really I know we've talked about this, but it is really weird that they're doing the rolling release.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know, but it, at least, you know, it's kind of close to each other. So I think it has more to do with the promotion of the movie so that they can fly people from, you know, the big talk shows in the U.S. But you also want to hit the big shows in Europe. And, you know, if you do everything at once, you don't get it. You don't get that extended coverage. So,
yes.
I mean, think, for instance, about... just having a gap 2 weeks between the official premiere and then the premiere in the United States, a guy like Stephen Colbert, he's doing an entire week about The Hobbit. And mm-hmm. so every day he interviews actors. He's had Ian McKellen and Martin Freeman. And he would never get that, you know, an audience for that if the movie had already been out in the open there and everybody knew about it. They can play the curiosity card. It's like, yeah, the movie is out, but almost no one knows what's really in it. So watch the Colbert Report and you'll get some more glimpses.
But I'm kind of surprised that it's not the other way around. I would expect that it would be first in, for example, New Zealand, because it was shot there, mm-hmm. and the United States, because that's the main audience, and then Europe two days later. But it's the other way around. So that puzzles me a little bit. Why the European audience, which is smaller than the American audience. But this, of course, this also premieres here on a Wednesday. And maybe there's kind of a something in the United States that's more it's better to premiere on a Friday.
The actual movie theater behavior might be different in the US. It's possible. It could also be that they hope that, you know, you get buzz in Europe and so perhaps, I don't know, it's more, they probably researched this very well.
I imagine.
And it can benefit the launch in the U.S. if you first get the buzz going in Europe. I don't know. Let's go to Gloin, played by Peter Hambleton.
All the sweat at the gym beforehand and the training really paid off. And we've got to take it to another level for filming next year. A lot more battle scenes and things like that. Look, heat and various factors meant at times it was very challenging, but we were so well looked after, you know.
What did you feel when you actually saw the movie all together, finally, in one piece?
I was absolutely flabbergasted. I mean, I fully expected it to be amazing in every way, but I really did just sit there open-mouthed and because I think I said to Peter, you know, you've set an extraordinary standard right off the bat, you know, for the first film. I think it's going to blow people's minds. I really do.
We've talked a little bit about the groundbreaking technology with the 48 frames per second. Tell me, what was your impression of it when you saw it? How will audiences react, do you think?
Well, I found, even though it's been part of my life for the last 2 years, you know, and I'm close to the story in that sense, I found I was just enchanted, hooked into it within a few seconds, the kind of depth and the quality of the images. And then the storytelling, you've got great acting right there from Ian Holm, right, for the first few seconds. I mean, what's not to love, you know?
You, of course, had a wonderful original story to work with.
About the best possible script writer you can have. But I think people will come to see how brilliantly clever Philippa and Fran and Peter and Guillermo originally have been in adapting it into three films.
And Peter, were you a Tolkien fan before you began?
Yes, I was one of those many, many people. I was lucky enough to have a wonderful teacher when I was at primary school who read us the whole book through 1 year. And I mean, there's many of us out there who just, it's very close to our heart, that story. So.
It's going to be very interesting to see what the book market is going to do after the launch of this movie. I know that with the Harry Potter movies, after the first movie came out, there was a surge of sales of the first book, and everybody who missed a boat kind of previously went back and start reading again. Also, to know what was, you know, how the story was going to evolve. That might happen with The Hobbit as well, where, you know, you're at the end of this first movie and it's like, so what happens next? Well, buy the book and you'll know. It's going to be interesting to see what will happen. Are there going to be any, like, new editions of The Hobbit or like re-editions, or I assume that there will be a movie companion or something with the story and photos from the first movie at least. I don't know. Anyway, without any new information there, let's move over to Barry Humphries, who, of course, is very well known in Australia and New Zealand by the Dame Edna character that he created, basically, you know, for I think for more than 10 years or 15 years, he played this grand lady with very, very opinionated lady, totally unknown, this character in the United States and Canada. I remember seeing Dame Edna on Dutch TV, but it wasn't...
And me too.
Not very, very well known, but at least that's kind of... when I heard Dame Edna, I was like, oh, sure, yeah, I know. I have a mental image. But he plays the Great Goblin in a role, of course, that required him to do most of his work in motion capture, and he's got some interesting remarks about that.
How did you react to the film when you saw it, Barry?
I've never seen it.
Ah! This is a first for you this evening in the embassy.
I'm still in this film.
You certainly are. You take a really key role, and you are a quite extraordinary creation. Tell me a little bit about the process of being made up for this role.
Well, you don't get much made up. This whole business of motion capture is a mysterious technical thing, and it's revolutionary. And this will be the most advanced movie ever made. You don't get made up. You have little spots put over you. And the computer does the rest. Don't tell me. It's a mystery. But I am very unrecognizable in this film, I hope.
You are unrecognizable, despite what Cate Blanchett said at the media conference this morning. Was it to be directed by Peter Jackson? What was that experience
like?
Well,
it is marvellous because Peter Jackson manages to get the best out of everyone. And the mood of the whole company, and that's not just the artists, but the whole technical crew, everyone involved in the film, is very high because of his personality. He's an amazing little guy.
There was a lot of dress-up for others in the film. Do you think Dame Edna might have been a little envious?
I think Dame Edna would love to have been in this film, but unfortunately, she's too old.
Are you looking forward to the two next films in the trilogy?
Well, I'm not really, because I'm not in any of them.
I'd wager that his character is going to be quite popular. I can't wrap my mind around, you know, him playing a great goblin. His voice and his way of speaking does not evoke a great goblin at all. So I'm not sure if his voice is going to be modified. We know what the great goblin looks like because, in most of the... Wasn't it the second trailer where... Actually, that's the kind of the joke at the end where the dwarves are like, you've got to be kidding me. And then that's the great goblin falling on them. And that's probably also his demise that we see there.
Yeah. We know what he's like. And I have seen... there have been several comments from people saying that, like... in the 48 frames per second, a high resolution thing that mm-hmm. the Great Goblin is pretty grotesque looking.
Okay. That has to be an expanded role. He features in the book, but it seems to me that knowing that they asked Barry Humphries to play the Great Goblin seems to indicate that this is going to be also, a almost comic relief, I think.
Yeah, yeah, I think so.
Yeah,
and it's clear that they've expanded the not just his role, but the whole whole sequence.
Yeah, right.
From the visuals we've seen, I mean, Goblin Town is much larger and more expansive than we're led to believe in the book. They've added all these named characters to the scenes and stuff. So,
when I saw the glimpses of what Goblin Town looks like in the trailers, it did remind me a lot about the way they portrayed the mines of Saruman. You know, with these same kind of drawbridges and structures, and even mm-hmm. the colors were quite similar. So, but then again, I also remember in the last production video, kind of a CGI shot where they were flying through the the town, and that was pretty impressive and different from what we saw in the Two Towers movie.
By the way, I wanted to revisit your comment about new editions. If you go on Amazon, you can find copies of the book that have Martin Freeman on the cover. And of course, also this fall was the 75th anniversary of the publication of The Hobbit. So there's all kinds of anniversary editions out.
Excellent. And just a reminder, if you want to purchase a new edition of The Hobbit on Amazon, we'd be very thankful if you could first go to thehobbit.sqpn.com. And there is an Amazon banner. If you click on it and then make your purchase, actually that helps us out as a podcast. So it's a very simple way to support us. Let's go to Mark Hadlow, who plays Dory. And he had an interesting tidbit, because apparently he met one of the Tolkien family members.
It's the most extraordinary experience of my career so far.
This is
amazing.
Tell me a little bit about being part of the Tolkien legacy, if you like. I mean, you know, how has it changed your life, Mark?
Well, it has. I mean, I've actually met his great-grandson, you know, Royd, who is just, what a lovely man he is. And so I keep having a joke with him saying, ladies and gentlemen, it's, you know, J.R. Tolkien's great-grandson. And but that's so infectious.
Yeah.
Because there's something about his style, there's something about his storytelling that is just full of fantasy, but it's a real fantasy. And you actually have to go on the travel. You have to do the journey. And if you don't, it ends up being a very discombobulated thing. And so you must do the journey. And I'm doing the journey with these wonderful actors and wonderful crew and wonderful director called Sir Peter Jackson, who's just an inspiration to all of us to get in there, as well as Philippa and Fran, of course.
I loved this interview with Mark Hadlow. He was beaming. I mean, you could tell that this man enjoyed every single second of his involvement in the movie. He was definitely one of the most enthusiastic members of the cast that I've seen during that red carpet premiere. And but very interesting that he seems to be good friends with Royd Tolkien. Dave, I thought that the Tolkien estate, the family, didn't want anything to do with this movie.
Well, there's a distinction between the Tolkien estate and some of the kids, especially the grandkids, and I've heard a lot of the younger Tolkiens, especially the grandchildren, are much more friendly to all this stuff, which, you know, in some sense isn't surprising. They're all trying to make careers for themselves. There's one of them is a novelist, and I'll be honest with you, before I saw this interview, I wasn't even aware there was a Tolkien named Royd.
Okay.
So I don't know what his story is, or maybe he's part of the black sheep branch of the family.
Isn't he son of Simon Tolkien?
That was kind of what I was imagining. If he is, Simon Tolkien is the one that's sort of on the outs with the estate.
Oh.
He's the one that is cooperative and runs around and goes to these things, and that is kind of not towing the party line.
And I was hoping that, wait a minute, this might be the future heir of the legacy, and so that Silmarillion movie might be somewhere in the future if, you know, Royd takes over the reins. But, yeah, probably
Royd
not.
Royd is the son of Hugh Baker and Michael Tolkien's daughter, Joan. So he's the great-grandson of J.R.R. Tolkien.
Right.
He prefers to use his mother's surname, Tolkien. Shocker.
Of course he does.
Oh, he was in the Return of the King. He plays a Gondorian ranger passing out arms to other rangers.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that there was a cameo.
Film producer and literary agent. Yes, so he needs to play nice with all these folks.
But yeah, interesting. And you saw the same thing happening with Peter Jackson, who was there with his daughter, and they asked her, mm-hmm. you know, are you going to take over, you know, what your father does? And she was like, well, perhaps I will. So there was a little bit of career pitching taking place there.
Mm-hmm.
And Daddy was, yeah, that would be really nice if my daughter could, you know, one day take over the reins. And how cool would it be if sometime in the future, like one of the grandchildren of Peter Jackson will make the Silmarillion with one of the grandchildren of Tolkien. I'm not holding my breath, but I would be excited. Let's go to a very important actor, very important character in the world of Middle-earth. Hugo Weaving, of course, Elrond.
It seemed to me that the elves were a bit English, and dare I say it, our dwarves were a bit Scottish-Irish.
Yeah, there's a Celtic thread that goes through certain of the peoples of Middle-earth, and actually once upon a time the elves had weird Celtic accents as well, but we abandoned that well before Lord of the Rings, and they became much more prim and proper.
And before you know it, you'll be involved in two more.
Yes, I'm not sure whether Elrond gets to be in the third film, but we'll see. They might drag him back. Who knows?
Elrond in the third film. I learned last week, I think, that he's not mentioned in the Battle of Five Armies.
No.
Is it possible that they write him in, or is he elsewhere? Does Tolkien say anything about that?
I think he's just mentioned as the White Council, so I can see him being involved in the Dol Guldur part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
But the Battle of Five Armies was between the Orcs and the Wargs of Mordor, the men of the Lake Town, the Dwarves around the Lonely Mountain,
mm-hmm.
the Eagles, and the Elves of Mirkwood. So there's no reason for Elrond to be there.
But it wouldn't be incompatible to bring him. He seems to suggest, Hugo Weaving, that is, that he's not sure yet, so that they're still working on the third movie.
This is really interesting. I talked for a while about this with Corey Olson because we don't know who was at the Battle of Dol Guldur. We just know that what we know about it is that the White Council put forth its strength and drove out the Necromancer. And of course, what we also know is that actually the Necromancer was Sauron and that he wasn't actually driven out, but it was a feint. But we don't really know who was there at present at that. But presumably, Elrond would have been there. Elrond, Saruman, Galadriel, they all would have been there. However, the way they're executed, the timeline actually for Elrond to be there is actually pretty awkward. So on the one hand, it seems like he would be included in that. On the other hand, it's not clear how he would have gotten, because the dwarves depart Rivendell on their quest and head toward Mirkwood, you know, and Elrond is still in Rivendell. And then by the time when the dwarves reach Mirkwood, that's when Gandalf departs to go participate in the battle against the Necromancer. And so for Elrond, in order for Elrond to get there geographically, he would have had to really hoof it. And if he left after the dwarves, it might have been particularly hard to get there to cross the Misty Mountains with the goblins all astir after the dwarves killed the great goblin. So in the timeline of the books, it would have been hard for him to get there. In the timeline of the film, where we're looking at a really compressed timeline with the White Council storyline, that in the books, they know, but at the time the dwarves are in Rivendell, they know everything about the Necromancer. They know it's Sauron. They know what he's up to. They've been planning this move. The White Council's been planning this move against him for 100 years.
Yeah.
In the way it looks like they're doing the movie, they want the identity of the Necromancer to be a mystery. So it's looking like they're probably not even going to discover who he is until maybe even the next film.
Mm-hmm.
And so there would be no reason for Elrond to be there. So I'm starting to think they're actually going to leave him out of the Battle of Dol Guldur, and it's mostly maybe just going to be Galadriel. In fact, we wonder if maybe this whole mission against the Necromancer and Dol Guldur is going to turn out to be kind of a rogue Galadriel Gandalf operation, and that maybe they even left the other White Council members out.
Wow, that'd be very interesting as a way to spin the story. Let's wrap things up with the final quote, and of course we need to end this episode with, well, the Hobbit who started it all. Bilbo Baggins. Martin Freeman about what it meant to him to play Bilbo Baggins.
Martin, I talked a little bit to your colleagues about the responsibility of taking on The Hobbit. And here you are in that pivotal role of Bilbo. How's that responsibility lying with you?
Well, it's obviously something I take seriously, but you take seriously every role you do, you know. You don't take it more seriously because it's a big role. But you're aware that it's a very beloved figure in literature. You're aware it's a very beloved character. So, yeah, you don't want to bugger it up. But with Pete at the helm and with a fantastic cast and crew around you, you're very well helped, you know.
Did you grow to love Bilbo?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, but no, totally. I'm very, very fond of this whole world now. As again, because I've said before, this wasn't really part of my world as a kid, so I had to come to it quite freshly as a grown-up. And I can totally see why it is so beloved by people, you know? Because it is by me now. I love Bilbo. I love the whole... You know, it's a fantastic world, it's a fantastic story, and I'm very genuinely honoured to be doing it, yeah.
The film is actually a whirlwind. There's so much pace to it, so much happens, yet I thought the beautiful thing is that you're the quiet centre in so many ways. Was that a deliberate thing from you?
Well, in a way, yes, but also, given that I'm not directing the film, I mean, the overseer, you know, the Oberleutnant does all that, you know, that's Pete's job. But I think, clearly he is, if you're the protagonist, then very often you are the calm centre at of the madness, you know? It's a bit like today. You know, there's lots of lovely, positive madness on today. I love it.
Bilbo Baggins as the calm center of the storm. I kind of like that analogy. And I can't wait to see how he plays Bilbo. I have like a mental image of the Bilbo I remember from when I read the Hobbit for the first time. And I always imagined Bilbo a little bit more chubby and older than the what we've seen so far from Martin Freeman's portrayal. So I hope I'll be able to kind of shed that mental image that I used to have. What about you, the two of you, Inge? How did you imagine Bilbo before you saw the photos of Martin Freeman?
Yeah, completely different. But that's always with movies. If you have a mental image and you see a movie, then it will always be different.
And Dave, did you have an idea of what your ideal Bilbo would be?
My mental image of Bilbo was polluted by the Rankin Bass cartoon, so I'm still fighting to get that out of my head.
What's going to be the fate of that cartoon now that these movies are coming out? Is it going to be watchable once you're used to this?
I think people who love the Peter Jackson films and have never seen the Rankin Bass ones will go and watch it and think it's garbage. People who've seen them before and love them now will never stop loving them, probably.
It's a bit like these vintage video games, like the first incarnation of Mario and the kids now that grow up on their Nintendo game computers with the three-dimensional versions, and then they go back to these 8-bit games, and it's like, is that Mario? But there is some charm to, you know, the old stuff. It isn't that old, but... Or we might see another, you know, surge in sales because that cartoon movie tells the entire story, isn't it? I mean, that if you watch that movie, you've got the entire story.
Yep.
So, yeah, it might actually benefit the movie. Who knows? And with that, unfortunately, because we can talk about this for many more hours, we're going to wrap up this premiere coverage of The Hobbit. And now we are all waited with bated breath until the moment that we get to see the movie. Next time that you will hear us, we will have watched the movie, and we will, of course, give you our very, very detailed review. I just imagine that this is going to be one of those, you know, like, how many shows will it take us to get past the first 15 minutes of the movie in terms of reviewing it? I think we're going to be very busy for a very long time. We're also planning on bringing in some hardcore Tolkien and Hobbit fans from the, let's say, the fan realm, people from the, you know, that are involved in the Lord of the Rings games and all sort of other people, and hear their take on The Hobbit and what they thought of the first movie. So we're going to have a lot of fun. Hope to see you soon in the next edition of Secrets of the Hobbit.
SQPN, leading the way in Catholic new media.